wrote, "You could have hated me for taking you from your family and your homeland. Instead, you taught me to read, befriended me, loved me." He stared at her. She stared at him. Then, hesitant, he leaned down and kissed her. Oh, dear, Siri thought, a dozen objections popping into her head. She found it difficult to move, to resist, or to do anything. Anything other than kiss him back. She felt hot. She knew that they needed to stop, lest the priesthood get exactly what they were waiting for. She understood all of these things. Yet those objections began to seem less and less rational as she kissed him, as her breathing grew more hurried. He paused, obviously uncertain what to do next. Siri looked up at him, breathing heavily, then pulled him down to kiss him again, feeling her hair bleed to a deep, passionate red. At that point, she stopped caring about anything else. Sesebron didn't know what to do, but she did. "I really am too hasty," she thought, as she pulled off her shift. "I need to get better at controlling my impulses. Some other time." Chapter 45. That night, Lightsong dreamed of T'Teller burning, of the God King dead, and of soldiers in the streets, of lifeless, killing people in colorful clothing, and of a black sword. Chapter 46. Vivenna choked down her meal. The dried meat tasted strongly of fish, but she had learned that by breathing through her mouth, she could ignore much of the flavor. She ate every bite, then washed the taste away with a few mouthfuls of warm, boiled water. She was alone in the room. It was a small chamber built onto the side of a building near the slums. Vasher had paid a few coins for a day in it, though he wasn't there at the moment. He'd rushed off to deal with something. She leaned back, food consumed, closing her eyes. She'd reached the point where she was so exhausted that she actually found it difficult to sleep. The fact that the room was so small didn't help. She couldn't even stretch out all the way. Vasher hadn't been exaggerating when he'd said that their work would be rigorous. Stop after stop, she spoke with Idrians, consoling them, begging them not to push Halandrin to war. There were no restaurants, as there had been with Denth, no dinners with men in fine clothing and guards, just group after group of tired, working-class men and women. Many of them weren't rebellious, and a large number of them didn't even live in the slums. But they were part of the Idrian community in T'Teller, and they could influence how their friends and family felt. She liked them, empathized with them. She felt far better about her new efforts than she had about her work with Denth, and so far as she could tell, Vasher was being honest with her. She had decided to trust those instincts. That was her decision. And that decision meant helping Vasher, for now. Vasher didn't ask her if she wanted to continue. He simply led her from location to location, expecting her to keep up. And so she did, meeting with the people and begging their forgiveness, despite how emotionally draining it was. She wasn't certain if she could repair what she had done, but she was willing to try. This determination seemed to gain her some respect from Vasher. It was much more reluctantly given than Denth's respect had been. Denth was fooling me the entire time. It was still hard to remember that fact. Part of her didn't want to. She leaned forward, staring at the bland wall in front of her in the box-like room. She shivered. It was a good thing that she'd been working herself so hard lately. It kept her from thinking about things. Discomforting things. Who was she? How did she define herself now that everything she'd been and everything she'd tried had collapsed around her. She couldn't be Vivenna, the confident princess, anymore. That person was dead, left behind in that cellar with Parlin's bloody corpse. Her confidence had come from naivete. Now she knew how easily she had been played. She knew the cost of ignorance, and she had glimpsed the grim truths of real poverty. Yet, she also couldn't be that woman, the waif of the streets, the thief, the beaten-down wretch. That wasn't for her. She felt as if those weeks had been a dream, brought on by the stress of isolation and trauma of her betrayal, fueled by becoming a drab and being suffocated by disease. To pretend that was the real her would be to parody those who truly lived on the streets, the people she'd hidden among and tried to imitate. Where did that leave her? Was she the penitent, quiet princess who knelt with bowed head, pleading with the peasants? This, too, was partially an act. She really did feel sorry. However, she was using her stripped pride as a tool. That wasn't her. Who was she? She stood up, feeling cramped in the tiny room, and pushed open the door. The neighborhood outside wasn't quite a slum, but it wasn't rich either. It was simply a place where people lived. There were enough colors along the street to be welcoming, but the buildings were small and held a number of families each. She walked along the street, careful not to stray too far from the room Vasher had rented. She passed trees, admiring their blooms. Who was she, really? What was left when one stripped away the princess and the hatred of Hallandrin? She was determined. That part of her she liked. She'd forced herself to become the woman she needed to be in order to marry the God King. She'd worked hard, sacrificing, to reach her goal. She was also a hypocrite. Now she knew what it was to be truly humble. Compared to that, her former life seemed more brash and arrogant than any colorful skirt or shirt. She did believe in Ostra. She loved the teachings of the five visions. Humility, sacrifice, seeing another's problems before your own. Yet she was beginning to think that she, along with many others, had taken this belief too far, letting her desire to seem humble become a form of pride itself. She now saw that when her faith had become about clothing instead of people, it had taken a wrong turn. She wanted to learn to awaken. Why? What did that say about her? That she was willing to accept a tool her religion rejected, just because it would make her powerful? No, that wasn't it. At least, she hoped it wasn't. Looking back on her recent life, she felt frustrated at her frequent helplessness, and that felt like part of who she really was. The woman who would do anything to be sure she wasn't helpless. That was why she'd studied so hard with the tutors in Idris. That was also why she wanted to learn how to awaken. She wanted as much information as she could get and wanted to be prepared for the problems that might come to her. She wanted to be capable. That might be arrogant, but it was the truth. She wanted to learn everything she could about how to survive in the world. The most humiliating aspect of her time in Teteller was her ignorance. She wouldn't make that mistake again. She nodded to herself. Time to practice, then, she thought, returning to the room. Inside, she pulled out a piece of rope, the one that Vasher had used to tie her up, the first thing that she had awakened. She'd since retrieved the breath from it. She went back outside, holding the rope between her fingers, twisting it, thinking. The commands that Denth taught me were simple phrases. Hold things. Protect me. He'd implied that the intent was important. When she'd awakened her bonds, she'd made them move as if part of her body. It was more than just the command. The command brought the life, but the intent, the instructions from her mind, brought focus and action. She stopped beside a large tree with thin, blossom-laden branches that drooped toward the ground. She stood beside a branch, touched the bark of the tree's trunk itself to use its color. She held out the rope to the branch. "Hold things," she commanded, reflexively letting out some of her breath. She felt an instant of panic as her sense of the world dimmed. The rope twitched. However, instead of drawing color from the tree, the awakening pulled color from her tunic. The garment bled gray, and the rope moved, wrapping like a snake around the branch. Wood cracked slightly as the rope pulled tight. However, the other end of the rope twisted in an odd pattern, writhing. Vivenna watched, frowning, until she figured out what was happening. The rope was twisting around her hand, trying to hold it as well. "Stop," Vivenna said. Nothing happened. It continued to pull tight. "Your breath to mine," she commanded. The rope stopped twisting, and her breath returned. She shook the rope free. "All right," she thought. "Hold things works, but it's not very specific. It will wrap around my fingers as well as the thing I wanted to tie up. What if I tried something else?" "Hold that branch," she commanded. Again, breath left her. More of it, this time. Her trousers drained of color, and the rope end twisted, wrapping around the branch. The rest of it remained still. She smiled in satisfaction. "So the more complicated the command, the more breath it requires." She took back her breath. As Vasher had explained, doing so didn't shock her senses, for it was a mere restoration to a normal state for her. If she'd gone several days without that breath, she'd have been overwhelmed by recovering its power. It was a little like taking a first bite of something very flavorful. She eyed her clothes, which were now completely gray. Out of curiosity, she tried awakening the rope again. Nothing happened. She picked up a stick, then awakened the rope. It worked this time, the stick losing its color, though it took a lot more breath. Perhaps this was because the stick wasn't very colorful. The tree trunk didn't work for color, though. Presumably, one couldn't draw color from something that was itself alive. She discarded the branch and fetched a few of Vasher's colored handkerchiefs from the room. She walked back to the tree. Now what? She thought. Could she put the breath into the rope now, then command it to hold something later? How would she even phrase that? "Hold things that I tell you to hold," she commanded. Nothing happened. "Hold that branch when I tell you." Again, nothing. "Hold whatever I say." Nothing. A voice came from behind.
"Tell it to hold when thrown."
Vivenna jumped, spinning. Vasher stood behind her, Nightblood held before him, point down. He had his pack over his shoulder. Vivenna flushed, glancing back at the rope. "Hold when thrown," she said, using a handkerchief for color. Her breath left her, but the rope remained limp, so she tossed it to the side, hitting one of the hanging tree branches. The rope immediately twisted about, locking the branches together and holding them tightly.
"That's useful," Vivenna said.
Vasher raised an eyebrow.
"Perhaps. Dangerous, though."
"Why?"
"Get the rope back."
Vivenna paused, realizing that the rope had twisted around branches that were too high for her to reach. She hopped up, trying to grab it.
"I prefer to use a longer rope,"
Vasher said, raising Nightblood by the blade and using its hooked crossguard to pull the branches down.
"If you always keep hold of one end, then you don't have to worry about it getting taken from you. Plus, you can awaken when you need to, rather than leaving a bunch of breath locked into a rope that you may or may not need."
Vivenna nodded, recovering her breath from the rope.
"Come on," he said, walking back toward the room. "You've made enough of a spectacle for one day."
Vivenna followed, noticing that several people on the street had stopped to watch her.
"How did they notice?" she asked. I wasn't that obvious about what I was doing.
Vasher snorted. And how many people in Teller walk around in gray clothing?
Vivenna blushed as she followed Vasher into the cramped room. He set down his pack and then leaned Nightblood against one wall. Vivenna eyed the sword. She still wasn't certain what to make of the weapon. She felt a little nauseated every time she looked at it, and the memory of how violently sick she'd felt when touching it was still fresh. Plus, there had been that voice in her head. Had she really heard it? Vasher had been characteristically tight-lipped when she'd asked about it, rebuffing her questions.
"Aren't you an Idrian?"
Vasher asked, drawing her attention as he settled down.
"Last I checked," she replied.
"You seem oddly fascinated with awakening for a follower of Ostra."
He spoke with eyes closed as he rested his head against the door.
"I'm not a very good Idrian," she said, sitting down. "Not anymore. I might as well learn to use what I have."
Vasher nodded.
"Good enough. I've never really understood why Ostracism suddenly turned its back on awakening."
"Suddenly?" He nodded, eyes still closed.
"Wasn't like that before the Many War."
"Really?"
"Of course," he said.
He often spoke that way, mentioning things that seemed far-fetched to her, yet saying them as if he knew exactly what he was talking about. No conjecture, no wavering, as if he knew everything. She could see why it was sometimes hard for him to get along with people.
"Anyway," Vasher said, opening his eyes, "did you eat all of that squid?"
She nodded. "Is that what that was?"
"Yes,"
he said, opening his pack, getting out another dried chunk of meat. He held it up.
"Want more?"
She felt sick. "No, thank you." He paused, noticing the look in her eyes.
"What? Did I give you a bad piece?"
She shook her head.
"What?"
"It's nothing." He raised an eyebrow. "I said it's nothing." She glanced away. "I just don't care for fish very much."
"You don't?"
he asked.
"I've been feeding it to you for 5 days now."
She nodded silently.
"You ate it every time."
"I'm dependent upon you for food," she said. "I don't intend to complain about what you give me." He frowned, then took a bite of squid and began chewing. He still wore his torn, almost ragged clothing, but Vivenna had now been around him enough to know that he kept it clean. He obviously had the resources to get new clothing, yet he chose to wear the worn and tattered things instead. He also wore the same half-scrub, half-beard on his face. It never seemed to get longer, yet she never saw him trim it or shave it. How did he manage to keep it just the right length? Was that intentional? Or was she reading too much into it?
"You aren't what I expected,"
he said.
"I would have been," she said, "a few weeks ago."
"I doubt it,"
he said, gnawing on his chunk of squid.
"That tenacious spirit you've got doesn't come from a few weeks on the streets. Neither does that sense of martyrdom."
She met his eyes. "I want you to teach me more about awakening." He shrugged.
"What do you want to know?"
"I don't even know how to answer that," she said. "Denth taught me a few commands, but that was the same day that you took me captive." Vasher nodded. They sat silent for a few minutes. "Well," she finally asked, "are you going to say anything?"
"I'm thinking,"
he said. She raised an eyebrow. He scowled.
"Awakening is something I've done for a very, very long time. I always have trouble trying to explain it. Don't rush me."
"It's okay," she said. "Take your time." He shot her a glance.
"Don't patronize me either."
"I'm not patronizing. I'm being polite."
"Well, next time,
Be polite with less condescension in your voice, he said.
Condescension, she thought. I wasn't condescending.
She eyed him as he sat, chewing on his dried squid. The more time she spent with him, the less frightening she found him, but the more frustrating.
He is a dangerous man, she reminded herself. He has left corpses strewn all over the city, using that sword of his to make people slaughter each other.
She considered running from him on several occasions, but had eventually decided that she'd be a fool to do so. She could find no fault in his efforts to stop the war, and his solemn promise in the basement that first day still stuck with her. She believed him, hesitantly. She just intended to keep her eyes open a little wider from now on.
All right, he said. I guess this is for the best. I'm getting tired of you walking around with that bright aura of yours that you can't even use.
Well,
I think we should start with theory, he said. There are four kinds of biochromatic entities. The first, and most spectacular, are the returned. They're called gods here in Hallandrin, but I'd rather call them spontaneous, sentient, biochromatic manifestations in a deceased host. What is odd about them is that they're the only naturally occurring biochromatic entity, which is theoretically the explanation for why they can't use or bestow their biochromatic investiture. Of course, the fact is that every living being is born with a certain biochromatic investiture. This could also explain why type 1s retain sentience.
Vivenna blinked. That wasn't what she had been expecting.
You're more interested in type 2 and type 3 entities.
Vasher continued,
type 2 being mindless manifestations in a deceased host. They are cheap to make, even with awkward commands. This is per the law of biochromatic parallelism. The closer a host is to a living shape and form, the easier it is to awaken. Biochroma is the power of life, and so it seeks patterns of life. That, however, leads us to another law, the law of comparability. It states that the amount of breath required to awaken something isn't necessarily indicative of its power once awakened. A piece of cloth cut into a square and a piece of cloth cut into the shape of a person will take very different amounts of breath to awaken, but it will be essentially the same once they have been invested. The explanation for this is simple. Some people think of awakening as pouring water into a cup. You pour until the cup is filled, and then the object comes to life. This is a false analogy. Instead, think of awakening as beating down a door. You pound and pound, and some doors are easier to open than others. But once they're open, they do about the same thing.
He glanced at her.
Understand?
She said. She'd spent her youth training with the tutors, but this was beyond even their methods of teaching. It's a little dense.
Well, do you want to learn or not?
You asked me if I understood, she thought, and I answered.
However, she didn't voice her objections. Better for him to keep talking.
Type 2 biochromatic entities, he said, are what people in Hallandrin call lifeless. They are different from type 1 entities in several ways. Lifeless can be created at will and require only a few breaths to awaken, anywhere between 1 and hundreds, depending on the commands used, and they feed off their own color when being invested. They don't present an aura when awakened, but the breath sustains them, keeping them from needing to eat. They can die and need a special alcohol solution to remain functional past a few years of awakened status. Because of their organic host, their breath clings to the body and cannot be withdrawn once invested.
I know a little about them, Vivenna said. Denth and his team have a lifeless.
Vasher fell silent.
Yes,
he finally said.
I know.
Vivenna frowned.
noticing a strange look in his eyes. They sat silently for a few moments.
"You were talking about lifeless and their commands?" she prompted.
Vasher nodded.
"They need a command to awaken them, just like anything else. Even your religion teaches about commands. It says that Ostra is the one who commands the return to come back."
She nodded.
"Understanding the theory of commands is tough. Look at Lifeless, for instance. It's taken us centuries to discover the most efficient ways to bring a body to a lifeless state. Even now, we're not sure if we understand how it works. I guess this is the first thing I'd like to get across to you. That biochroma is complicated, and we really don't understand most of it."
"What do you mean?" she asked.
"Just what I said,"
Vasher replied, shrugging.
"We don't really know what we're doing."
"But you sound so technical and precise in your descriptions."
"We have figured out some things," he said. "But awakeners really haven't been around that long. The more you learn about biochroma, the more you'll realize that there are more things that we don't know than there are things we do. Why are the specific commands so important? And why do they have to be spoken in your native language? What brings Type 1 entities, returned, back to life in the first place? Why are lifeless so dull-minded, while returned, fully sentient?"
Vivenna nodded.
"Creating Type 3 biochromatic entities is what we traditionally call awakening."
Vasher continued.
"That's when you create a biochromatic manifestation in an organic host that is far removed from having been alive. Cloth works the best, though sticks, reeds, and other plant matter can be used."
"What about bones?" Vivenna asked.
"They're strange," Vasher said. "They take far more breath to awaken than a body held together with flesh and aren't as flexible as something like cloth. Still, breath will stick to them fairly easily, since they were once alive and maintain the form of a living thing."
"So Idrian's stories that talk about skeletal armies aren't just fabrications?"
He chuckled.
"Oh, they are. If you want to awaken a skeleton, you'd have to arrange all the bones together in their correct places. That's a lot of work for something that will take upwards of 50 or 100 breaths to awaken. Intact corpses make far more sense economically, even if the breath sticks to them so well that it becomes impossible to recover. Still, I've seen some very interesting things done with skeletons which have been awakened. Anyway, Type 3 entities, regular awakened objects, are different. Biochroma doesn't stick to them very well at all. The result is that they require quite a bit of investiture, often well over 100 breaths, to awaken them. The benefit of this, of course, is that the breath can be drawn back out again. This has allowed for quite a bit more experimentation, and that has resulted in a more comprehensive understanding of awakening techniques."
"You mean the commands?" Vivenna asked.
"Right,"
Vasher said.
"As you've seen, most basic commands work easily. If the command is something the object could do, and you state it in a simple way, the command will usually work."
"I tried some simple commands," she said, "on the rope. They didn't work."
"Those may have sounded simple, but they weren't. Simple commands are only 2 words long. Grab something, hold something, move up, move down. Twist around. Even some 2-word commands can be more complicated, and it takes practice visualizing. Or, well, imagining. Well, using your mind to..."
"I understand that part," she said. "Like flexing a muscle."
He nodded.
"The command, protect me, though only 2 words, is extremely complicated. So are others, like fetch something. You have to give the right impulse to the object. This area is where you really begin to understand how little we know. There are probably thousands of commands we don't know. The more words you add, the more complicated the mental component becomes. Which is why discovering a new command can take years of study."
Like the discovery of a new command to make lifeless, she said thoughtfully. 300 years ago, those who had the one-breath command could make their lifeless much more cheaply than those who didn't. That disparity started the Many War.
Yes, Vasher said. Or at least, that was part of what caused the war. It's not really important. The thing to understand is that we're still children when it comes to awakening. It doesn't help that a lot of people who learn new, valuable commands never share them, and probably die with knowledge.
Vivenna nodded, noticing how his lesson grew more relaxed and conversational as he got into the topic. His expertise surprised her. He sits on the floor, she thought, eating a dry piece of squid, not having shaven in weeks, and wearing clothing that looks like it's about to fall off. Yet he talks like a scholar giving a lecture. He carries a sword that leaks black smoke and causes people to kill each other. Yet he works so hard to stop a war. Who is this man? She glanced to the side, to where Nightblood sat leaning against the wall. Perhaps it was the discussion of the technical aspects of Biochroma, or perhaps it was simply her growing suspicion. She was beginning to understand what wasn't right about the sword. What is Type 4 biochromatic entity? Vivenna asked, glancing back at Vasher. He fell silent. Type 1 is a human body with sentience, Vivenna said. Type 2 is a human body without sentience. Type 3 is an awakened object, like a rope, an object with no sentience. Is there a way to create an awakened object with sentience? Like a returned, but inside of something other than a human body? Vasher stood.
We've covered enough for one day.
You didn't answer my question.
And I'm not going to, he said, and I advise you never to ask it again. Understand?
He glanced at her, and she felt a chill at the harshness in his voice. All right, she said, though she didn't glance away. He snorted to himself, then reached into his large pack, yanking something out.
Here, he said, I brought you something.
He tossed a long, cloth-wrapped object to the floor. Vivenna stood, walking over to pull the cloth off. Inside was a thin, well-polished dueling blade. I don't know how to use one of these, she said.
Then learn, he replied. If you know how to fight, you'll be far less annoying to have around. I won't have to keep pulling you out of trouble all the time.
She flushed. One time.
It'll happen again, he said.
She hesitantly picked up the sheathed sword, surprised at how light it was.
Let's go, Vasher said. I've got another group for us to visit.
Chapter 47. Lightsong tried not to think about his dreams. He tried not to think about T'Teller in flames, of people dying, of the world, essentially, ending. He stood on the second story of his palace, looking over the Court of Gods. The second story was essentially a covered roof, open on all sides. Wind blew through his hair. The sun was close to setting. Already, torches were arrayed on the lawn. It was so perfect. The palaces set in a circle, lit by torches and lanterns matching the colors of the nearest building. Some of the palaces were dark, the buildings that currently held no gods. What would happen if too many others returned before we killed ourselves? He thought idly. Would they build more palaces? As far as he knew, there had always been enough space. At the head of the court sat the God King's palace, tall and black. It had obviously been built so that it would dominate even the extravagant mansions of the others, and it threw a wide, warped shadow across the back wall. Perfect, so perfect. The torches were arranged in patterns he could only see by standing atop a building. The grass was kept manicured, and the massive wall tapestries were replaced often so that they showed no wear, stains, or fading. The people put forth such effort for their gods. Why? Sometimes it baffled him. But what to think of other faiths, ones with no visible gods, only incorporeal imaginings or wishes? Surely those gods did even less for their people than the Halandrin court, yet they still were worshipped. Lightsong shook his head. Meeting with Allmother had reminded him of days he hadn't thought of in a long time. Calmseer. She had been his mentor when he'd first returned. Blushweaver was jealous of his memories of her, but she didn't understand the truth. Nor could he, really, explain it. Calmseer had come closer to being a divinity than any returned Lightsong had known. She'd cared for her followers as much as Allmother now tried to do. But there had been genuine concern in Calmseer's regard. She hadn't helped the people because she feared that they would stop worshipping. She had no arrogance of presumed superiority. Real kindness, real love, real mercy. Yet even Calmseer had felt inadequate. She had often said she felt guilty because she couldn't live up to what people expected. How could she? How could anyone? In the end, he suspected this was what drove her to answer a petition. There had only been one way, in her estimation, to be the goddess everyone demanded she be, and that was to give up her life. They push us into it, Lightsong thought. They craft all of this splendor and luxury. They give us whatever we desire. Then they subtly poke at us. Be a god. Prophesy. Maintain our illusion for us. Die. Die so that we can keep believing. He usually stayed off his roof. He preferred to be down below, where the limited perspective made it so much easier to ignore the larger view, so much easier to focus on simple things, like his life in the moment.
Your Grace,
Larimar asked quietly, approaching. Lightsong didn't reply.
Are you all right, Your Grace?
No man should be this important, Lightsong said.
Your Grace?
Larimar asked, walking up beside him. It does strange things to you. We weren't built for it.
You're a god, Your Grace. You were built for it.
No, he said. I'm no god.
Excuse me, but you don't really get to choose. We worship you, and that makes you our god.
Larimar spoke the words in his usual calm fashion. Didn't the man ever get upset? You're not helping.
I apologize, Your Grace, but perhaps you should stop arguing about the same old things.
Lightsong shook his head. This is something different today. I'm not sure what to do.
You mean about Allmother's commands?
Lightsong nodded. I thought I had it figured out, Scoot. I can't keep up with all of the things Blushweaver is plotting. I've never been good at details. Larimar didn't respond. I was going to give it up, Lightsong said. Allmother was doing a fantastic job of standing up for herself. I figured that if I gave her my commands, then she'd know what to do. She'd understand if it's better to support Blushweaver or oppose her.
You could still just let her,
Larimar said.
You gave her your commands, too.
I know, Lightsong said. They fell silent. So it comes down to this, he thought. The first of us who changes those commands takes control of all 20,000. The other will be locked out. What did he choose? Did he sit back and let history happen, or did he jump in and make a mess of it?
Whoever you are, he thought, whatever is out there that sent me back, why couldn't you just let me be? I'd already lived one life. I'd already made my choices. Why did you have to send me back? He'd tried everything, and yet people still looked to him. He knew for a fact that he was one of the most popular returned, visited by more petitioners and given more art than almost anyone else. Honestly, he thought, what is wrong with these people? Were they so in need of something to worship that they chose him rather than worry that their religion might be false? All-Mother claimed that some did think that. She worried about the perceived lack of faith among the common people. Lightsong wasn't certain he agreed with her. He knew of the theories, that the gods who lived the longest were the weak ones because the system encouraged the best to sacrifice themselves quickly. However, the same number of petitioners came to him now as when he first started. Plus, too few gods were chosen on the whole for that to be statistically valid. Or was he just distracting himself with irrelevant details? He leaned on the railing, looking out over the green and its glowing pavilions. This could be the crowning moment for him. He could finally prove himself to be an indolent wastrel. It was perfect. If he did nothing, then All-Mother would be forced to take up the armies and resist Blushweaver. Was that what he wanted? All-Mother kept herself isolated from the other gods. She didn't attend many court assemblies and didn't listen to the debates. Blushweaver was intimately involved. She knew every god and goddess well. She understood the issues, and she was very clever. Of all the gods, only she had begun taking steps to secure their armies. Ciri is no threat, he thought. But if someone else were manipulating her, would All-Mother have the political savvy to understand the danger? Without his concerned guidance, would Blushweaver see that Ciri wasn't crushed? If he did walk away, there would be a cost. He would be to blame, for he'd given up. Who was she, Larimar? Lightsong asked quietly. The young woman in my dreams. Was she my wife? The high priest didn't answer. I need to know, Lightsong said, turning. This time, I really need to know. Larimar frowned, then looked away. No, he said quietly. She was not your wife. My lover? He shook his head. But she was important to me. Very, Larimar said. And is she still alive? Larimar wavered, then finally nodded his head. Still alive, Lightsong thought. If this city fell, then she would be in danger. Everyone who worshipped Lightsong, everyone who counted on him despite his best efforts, would be in danger. Teteller couldn't fall. Even if there were war, the fighting wouldn't come here. Halandrin wasn't in danger. It was the most powerful kingdom in the world. And what of his dreams? He had been given only one real duty in the government, that of taking command of 10,000 lifeless, of deciding when they should be used and when they should not be. Still alive. He turned and walked toward the steps. The lifeless enclave was technically part of the Court of Gods. The huge building was built at the base of the court plateau, and a long covered walkway ran down to it. Lightsong moved down the steps with his entourage. They passed several guard posts, though he wasn't sure why they needed guards in a hallway leading from the court. He had only visited the enclave a couple of times, primarily during his first few weeks as a returned, when he had been required to give the security phrase to his 10,000 soldiers.
Perhaps I should have come more often, he thought. What would have been the point? Servants cared for the lifeless, making certain their ichor alcohol was fresh, that they exercised, and did whatever else it was that lifeless did. Larimar and several of the other priests were puffing from the long, brisk walk by the time they reached the bottom of the steps. Lightsong, of course, had no trouble, as he was in perfect physical condition. There were some things about godhood that never made him complain. A couple of guards opened the doors into the compound. It was gigantic, of course. It contained space for 40,000 lifeless. There were four large warehouse-like storage areas for the different groups of lifeless, a track for them to run around, a room filled with various stones and blocks of metal for them to lift to keep their muscles strong, and a medical area where their ichor alcohol was tested and refreshed. They passed through several twisting passages designed to confuse invaders who might try to strike at the lifeless, then approached a guard post set beside a large open doorway. Lightsong passed the living human guards and looked in at the lifeless. He'd forgotten that they kept them in the dark. Larimar waved for a couple of priests to hold up lamps. The door opened onto a viewing platform. The floor of the warehouse extended below, filled with line upon line of silent, waiting soldiers. They wore their armor and carried their weapons in sheaths. There are holes in the ranks, Lightsong said.
Some of them will be exercising, Larimar replied. I have sent a servant to fetch them.
Lightsong nodded. The lifeless stood with eyes open. They didn't shuffle or cough. Staring out over them, Lightsong suddenly remembered why he never felt any desire to return and inspect his troops. They were simply too unnerving.
Everyone out, Lightsong said.
Your Grace, Larimar asked. Don't you want a few priests to stay?
Lightsong shook his head. No, I will bear this phrase myself. Larimar hesitated, but then nodded, doing as ordered. In Lightsong's opinion, there was no good way of keeping command phrases. Leaving them in the hands of a single god was to risk losing the phrase through assassination. However, the more people who knew the command phrases, the more likely it was that the secret would be bribed or tortured out of someone. The only mitigating factor was the God King. Apparently, with his powerful biochroma, he could break lifeless more quickly. Still, taking control of 10,000 would require weeks, even for the God King. The choice was left to the individual returned. They could let some of their priests hear the command phrase, so that if something happened to the god, the priests could pass the phrase on to the next returned. If the god chose not to give the phrase to his priests, then he placed an even larger burden on himself. Lightsong had found that option silly, years before, and had included Larimar and several others in the secret. This time he saw wisdom in keeping the phrase to himself. Should he get the chance, he would whisper it to the God King. But only him.
Bottom line blue, he said.
I give you a new command phrase.
He paused.
Red Panther. Red Panther. Step to the right side of the room.
A group of the lifeless near the front, those who could hear his voice, moved over to the side. Lightsong sighed, closing his eyes. A part of him had hoped that All-Mother had come here first, that she had already changed the command phrase. But she hadn't. He opened his eyes, then took the steps down to the warehouse floor. He spoke again, changing the phrase for another group. He could do about 20 or 30 at a time. He remembered the process taking hours the last time. He continued. He would leave the lifeless with their basic instructions to obey the servants when they asked the creatures to exercise or go to the infirmary. He'd give them a lesser command that could be used to move them about and make them march to specific locations, as when they had been placed in ranks outside the city to greet Ciri, and another
to make them go with members of the city guard to provide extra muscle. Yet there would be only one person with ultimate command of them, one person who could make them go to war. When he was done in this room, he would move on, taking utter command of all Mother's 10,000 as well. He would draw both armies to him, and in doing so, he would take his place at the very heart of the fate of two kingdoms. Chapter 48. Sesebron didn't leave in the mornings anymore. Ciri lay in the bed beside him, curled slightly, her skin against his. He slept peacefully, chest going up and down, the white bedsheets throwing out prismatic colors around him as they inevitably reacted to his presence. A few months back, who could have understood where she'd find herself? Not only married to the God King of Halandrin, but in love with him as well. She still thought it amazing. He was the most important religious and secular figure in the whole of the Inner Sea area. He was the basis for worship of the Halandrin iridescent tones. He was a creature feared and hated by most people in Idris. And he was dozing quietly at her side. A god of color and beauty, his body as perfectly sculpted as a statue. And what was Ciri? Not perfect, of that she was sure. And yet, somehow, she'd brought to him something that he needed. A hint of spontaneity, a breath from the outside, untamed by his priests or his reputation. She sighed, head resting on his chest. There would be a price to be paid for their enjoyment these last few nights. We really are fools, she thought idly. We only have to avoid one thing, giving the priests a child. We're aiming ourselves straight toward disaster. She found it hard to berate herself too firmly. She suspected that her act wouldn't have fooled the priests for much longer. They would grow suspicious, or at least frustrated, if she continued it without producing an heir. She could imagine them interfering if faced with more stalling. Whatever she and Sesebron did to change events, they would have to do it quickly. He stirred beside her, and she twisted, looking at his face as he opened his eyes. He regarded her for a few minutes, stroking her hair. It was amazing how quickly they had become comfortable in their intimacy. He reached for his writing board. I love you. She smiled. It was always the first thing he wrote in the mornings. And I love you, she said. However, he continued, we are probably in trouble, aren't we? Yes. How long? He asked. Until it's obvious that you will bear a child, I mean. I'm not sure, she said, frowning. I don't have much experience with this, obviously. I know that some of the women back in Idris complained of not being able to have children as quickly as they wanted, so maybe it doesn't always happen immediately. I know other women who bore children almost exactly 9 months after their wedding night. Sesebron looked thoughtful. A year from now, I could be a mother, Ciri thought. She found the concept daunting. Up until a short time ago, she hadn't really thought of herself as an adult. Of course, she thought, feeling a bit sick, according to what we've been told, any children I bear the God King will be stillborn anyway. Even if that was a lie, her child would be in danger. She still suspected that the priests would spirit it away, then replace it with a returned. In all likelihood, Ciri would then be made to disappear as well. Blue Fingers tried to warn me, she thought. He spoke of danger, not only to Sesebron, but to me. Sesebron was writing. I've made a decision, he wrote. Ciri raised an eyebrow. I want to try making myself known to the people, he wrote, and the other gods.
I want to take control of my kingdom for myself.
I thought we decided that would be too dangerous.
It will be, he wrote. But I'm beginning to think that it is a risk we must take.
And your objections from before? She asked. You can't shout out the truth, and your guards are likely to rush you away if you try something like escaping.
Yes, Sesebron wrote, but you have far fewer guards, and you can yell.
Ciri paused. Yes, she said. But would anyone believe me? What would they think if I just started screaming about how the God King is being held prisoner by his own priests? Sesebron cocked his head. Trust me, she said. They'd think that I was crazy.
What if you gain the confidence of the returned you often speak about? He wrote, Light Song the Bold.
Ciri gave that some thought.
You could go to him, Sesebron wrote. Tell him the truth. Perhaps he will lead you to other returned he thinks might listen. The priests will not be able to silence us all.
Ciri lay beside him for a moment, head still resting on his chest. It sounds possible, Seb, but why not just run? My serving women are from Pankal now. Bluefingers has said that he will try to get us out, if I ask. We can flee to Idris.
If we flee, Halandrin troops will follow, Ciri. We would not be safe in Idris.
We could go somewhere else, then. He shook his head.
Ciri, I have been listening to the arguments in the Court of Judgment. There will soon be war between our kingdoms. If we run, we will be abandoning Idris to invasion.
The invasion will happen if we stay, too.
Not if I take control of my throne, Sesebron wrote. The people of Halandrin, even the gods, are obligated to obey me. There will be no war if they know I disapprove.
He erased, then continued, writing faster.
I have told the priests that I don't wish to go to war, and they appeared sympathetic. However, they have done nothing.
They are probably worried, Ciri said. If they let you start making policy, then you may begin to think that you don't need them.
They'd be right, he wrote, smiling. I need to become the leader of my people, Ciri. That is the only way to protect your beautiful hills and the family you love so much.
Ciri fell silent, offering no further objections. To do as he was saying would be to play their hand, make a gamble for everything. If they failed, the priests would undoubtedly figure out that Ciri and Sesebron were in communication. That would spell the end of their time alone together. Sesebron obviously noticed her concern.
It is dangerous, but it is the best option. Fleeing would be just as risky, and it would leave us in far worse circumstances. In Idris, we would be seen as the reason the Halandrin armies had come. Other countries would be even more dangerous.
Ciri slowly nodded. In another country, they'd have no money and would make perfect subjects for ransom. They'd escape the priests only to find themselves being held captive to be used against Halandrin. The Kingdom of Iridescence was still widely disliked because of the many war.
We'd be taken captive, as you say, she acknowledged. Plus, if we were in another country, I doubt we'd be able to get you a breath every week. Without them, you'd die.
He looked hesitant.
What? She asked.
I would not die without breath, he wrote. But that is not an argument in favor of flight.
You mean the stories of returned needing breath to live are lies? Ciri asked incredulously.
Not at all, he wrote quickly. We do need breath. But you forget that I hold the wealth of breath passed down for generations in my family.
I heard my priests speak of this once. If it were necessary to move me, I could survive on the extra breaths I hold.